like to read an account that I think is going to be familiar to all of you, and think a little bit about some of its meanings and some ways that perhaps we might be helped and encouraged to live and to think about some of the ways we reach out to people in light of the account of this rather unusual action on the part of a woman friend of Jesus as she anticipated his closing days and hours leading up to his death. Mark 14, and I'll be reading the first 11 verses, and I think you'll see in a while why I've called this a precious and timely gift. After 2 days beyond what was previously described, it was the Passover and the Feast of Unleavened Bread. And the chief priests and the scribes were seeking how they might take Jesus by trickery and put him to death. But they said, not during the feast, lest there be an uproar of the people. Now, being in Bethany at the house of Simon the leper, as Jesus sat at the table, or at least was there at the meal, a woman came carrying an alabaster flask of very costly oil of spikenard. She broke the flask and poured it on his head. And by the way, some of the Gospels add sort of letting it flow down on his clothing and lower parts of his body. And there were some who were indignant among themselves, and they said, why this fragrant oil was wasted? It might have been sold for more than 300 denarii and given to the poor. And they criticized her sharply. But Jesus said, let her alone. Why do you trouble her? She's done a good work for me. For you have the poor with you always, and whenever you wish, you may do them good. But me you don't have always. She's done what she could. She's come beforehand to anoint my body for burial, and assuredly, I say to you, wherever this gospel is preached in the whole world, what this woman has done will be told as a memorial to her. The very fact that I'm reading this to you tonight is evidence of exactly that. Then Judas Iscariot, one of the 12, went to the chief priests to betray Jesus to them. And when they heard it, they were glad. They promised to give him money. And so he sought how he might conveniently betray Jesus. The story we've just read shows up in three Gospels, okay? Matthew, Mark, and also the Gospel of John. It's a rather unusual occasion, and I think the slightly unusual behavior speaks for itself. It would have been not totally typical in that day either, although perhaps even more so in ours. The other gospel, it doesn't mention this story, which is Luke, does have in the chapter 7 of that gospel kind of a similar incident that seems to have maybe occurred earlier in Jesus' ministry. It's hard for me to put the pieces together, so it's possible there was maybe a separate incident like this. Anyway, we're with Mark tonight, and the manner in which Mark tells us his story, his version of the story, prompts my title, and I'll show you why. And he opens it up in a way in which he's going to alternate with some things in which he tells about something and then illustrates it. And I'd like to show you that in the next few minutes also. It's clear by the time you get to the 10th chapter of Mark that Jesus is articulating to his inner circle that he is very clear where he's going, why he's going there, what's going to unfold. He is clearly going to Jerusalem to die. And his intention is set there, it's fixed, it's determined, and in some gentle but very clear ways, he's opening this up to the people in his circle. I'd like to just pause before I go any further to just ask something. Imagine planning your days so that you may die well. I read a story some years ago about a Puritan. I've lost the name. I can't tell you which Puritan it was, but he was facing execution for his beliefs, and he wrote in his journal, "There is nothing which so focuses a man's life as to know he is to be hung in 2 weeks." That gave me a little bit of a taste through somebody else's eyes. A little bit closer to home, a man who is known to some of you, Willard McMillan, was on his third round of cancer in his late 70s, and he had retired from the college and from other pastoral ministries, and he and I were chatting one day, and he explained to me what I sort of knew, that the doctors had said in this particular round he'd had three different cancers. And he said they had given him, their best estimation was that they could alleviate some things. They couldn't ultimately treat it or fix it. And when he asked them, how long? And they said, we don't know. Count your life in months rather than years. And he said to me this, and I take it it's okay to have relayed the story. He said it faced him with an interesting question he'd never faced before. He said when he'd had his earlier round of cancer, one in his 40s, one in his 60s, he said he knew he could draw near to God, but couched within those times was the hope, and it was a hope that was answered, that he could draw near to God and he could ask to be healed and look for a restoration. And now he said, and he said this to me, he said, I've got an interesting challenge, he said. I've got to see if I can still love God intimately and not have attached to it an expectation that there'll be a restoration. And he said it's a new zone he hadn't been in. And sometime later, I was visiting him again on the second visit. Well, there were many visits, but on the second I'm talking about, neither he nor I knew. He was only about 2 weeks away from the end of his life. I said to him, Willard, how is your pursuit going? And he smiled and he said, well, I think I'm succeeding. And again, it was just this expression of a man who had walked a godly life by anyone's standards. And it showed in the relationships and the legacies he'd left, but also wrestling with the fact that having to focus his life, could he do it with the pure intentions and see something good come of it? And I believe he did. So here's Jesus, who we know, quote, gave his life as a ransom for many, now within a short corridor, looking to what he, with his unlimited knowledge, could say, by anyone's estimations, was going to be a very, very difficult time. So Mark's account is showing us, as he tells the account of this woman, coming back now to the woman's story, the circumstances are severe. And Jesus is clear on it, and he's opening up this to others. And tucked within this certainty that the corridor will end violently, painfully, and tragically, at least as humans count tragedy, tucked into that is this encounter with this woman. It's fascinating. It takes place at a home. The home of a guy we simply know as Simon the Leper. I don't know how I would feel about being known by that, Jonathan the Sick. I don't think I want to be known that way, no matter how sick I might be. And but there it is. That's the label, and that's all we have. Seems to have some connection with the home of Mary, Martha, and Lazarus. It's in a bedroom community just on the outskirts of Jerusalem. Today, that community has been swallowed up by urban sprawl. But back then, a couple miles just outside of town, and often when people would come for special events like Passover, they would seek out friends and connections in the Bethphage, Bethany area. Just about a half an hour, 45-minute walk, you were into town. At the end of the day, you were back out of town. It was a convenient kind of thing, early equivalent of Holiday Inn. And there, they encounter these three sisters. We know other stories about them. Jesus had some kind of a very close relationship with this family. And here is this woman, identified elsewhere as Mary, of that family, who does this unusual thing. Now, I'm going to take a few pieces from the other Gospels, so not all were right in this reading from Mark. She takes a Roman pound, 12 ounces, of a very expensive spikenard mixed with oil, typically an olive oil or something like that, as a kind of a medium in which to mix these very expensive spices. Why did she break the jar? Simply because when you have an exceptionally expensive import like this, you have it sealed in a jar to keep it safe. May have traveled a very long time, may have been saved for many, many years. So it was hard sealed until you were ready to use it, and you would crack the neck of it, and then, of course, use it as will at will, but no way to effectively seal it up. She, of course, lavishly pours it, as it's clear from the other Gospels, not only on Jesus' head, but on the rest of his body, and then taking her long hair, which, by the way, women customarily would not let down in public. They would keep it tied up and bound at the back, roughly comparable to what we know as a bun or something like that. She lets it down, probably a little bit of a discomfort or shock to others. She would do this in public, and then wiped the perfume from his feet. Valued at, well, 300 denarii. Let me just give you an illustration that'll impress you, I hope. I don't want to give you a dollar equivalent. That's always tricky how to do that. A denarius, a little silver coin, no bigger than your thumbnail, okay? Silver coin. A day's wage for a laborer. Now, whether this price is real or whether it's inflated, I don't know. It's a valuable product. If it is worth 300 days' wages, you calculate with any dollar figure you'd like, and that's what she just poured over Jesus. Now, to help your calculation, a little story from one of my colleagues who has spoken over the years at many, many churches, has been valued in his ministry. His name is Terry. Terry had a medium-length ministry at a certain church in the Pittsburgh area that was so appreciated by one of the men in the church. So one day he got a phone call from the guy in this church who said, "Terry, I want you to come over. I want to show you something." Terry comes over. The guy has just bought a brand new Buick sports car. Terry admires it, and the guy throws him the keys and says, "It's yours. Thank you for your ministry." I thought, that's not bad, okay? That ought to be a precedent for all churches, right? And I'm thinking, I know the approximate value of the sports car. 300 days' wages probably is something comparable, except she just expended it all. Done. Now, I've never done this because I know people have allergies, but if I took a couple ounces of some beautiful perfume and literally in this closed room just poured it out, can you imagine the effect as it fills your nostrils, takes over your eyes, owns you? And that's what she did in a very, very small room. So, by the way, it's interesting. Fragrant spices, you realize, frame Jesus' ministry. He's born and gets gifts of spices and gold. And as he approaches death, more gifts of spices. Anyway, back to this. Gossip for a small town, this extravagant act. Jesus stood up for her. He had to, because people are thinking this is strange, this is out of control, this is odd. And of course, he praises. He doesn't ridicule, he praises her. And protects her, I think, from having a kind of a, maybe a shame that might have been brought to her family, yours as the family, where this out-of-control woman wasted all this so suddenly on this man. You know, at Passover, it is customary in that culture to give your gifts to the poor. And yet Jesus welcomes it to him. Let's talk about this for a few moments, then draw some purposes. A kind deed, understatement, verse 6. She's done a kind deed for me. Do you realize kind deeds, big and small, the opportunities come and go very quickly? I remember as a college student being hosted for a weekend at a woman's house. She was in her 30s. I knew she had cancer. She had three kids. And before I got to say thank you, she was gone. So opportunities to say kindness, opportunities to do kindness, sometimes they come and go faster than we were thinking. Jesus weighs the value, she weighed the value, excuse me, between Jesus and the poor, and it would be appropriate to help people in need. How would you ever say no to that? And yet, do you realize what she's thinking? This is an opportunity that will come and go, and when it's gone, I can't have it back again. Next week, next month, next year, I have people to help, but him I won't have again. And you know, it says in verse 8, it's so short, I hope you won't miss it, she was grieving. In so many words, it doesn't use the word, but in so many words, she was grieving. She anointed my body beforehand. She is sad at what she's going to lose. Now, it won't be an ultimate loss, but for the time being, it is. And she is able, this is interesting, to distinguish between what is customary, do something good for someone needy over there, versus what is necessary. Here's an opportunity I need to take right now, because it won't be here again. As I see it, that takes tremendous perception. And it also takes a risk, because to show this kind of affection, by the way, there's nothing objectively wrong with it, but to show this kind of affection as others watch, I think many people would rather just stay back and not let it show. And here it's given, and in a loving and a tender fashion. Do you realize, as Judas calculates how to sell his friend to get a few denarii, she is saying goodbye by giving all that she has. What a wonderful and what an ironic twist. What a commodity to give away. It's not just the thing, it's herself. And a precious gift in a close friendship. I find it fascinating. The apostles, they seem to be a mixed bag. They sort of get what's happening. Enough that Peter would try and talk Jesus out of going. You remember that? So they get enough of that, a little bit at least. And yet she can catch the timing and realize the connection. Oh, he's in Jerusalem now. Days are short. Opportunities come and go. She sees it in a way no one else seems to. So, precious gifts. How about this? Can you distinguish between being very sort of generally good and doing the generally right kind of thing as opposed to being passionately good? It's a fine line of difference. You can be generally Jesus-like. How would Jesus behave? Not a bad place to start, by the way. How would Jesus behave? What might he say? What might he do? Good things to think about and a good place to start. This, however, is over and above board. This is just outright aggressive generosity. You know, this is what I can do to be extraordinarily giving, loving, outreaching. And I think we have a question here. Can we go from the customarily good to the passionately, I'm all about being what God wants me to be, kind of good? I'm reminded of a friend who loves to say, salvation is free, but it costs you your life. The principle is true, but the invitation is always to give away more, because let's face it, if you've been given your soul and eternity and these kind of promises, what more can you be given? There's nothing else to be given. You have it all already. Why not then turn around and be willing to give it away? You won't lack. There'll always be more to have. That's the position I think she's in. She is able to look at someone, and I'd like to quote here, she's able to look at someone and see beyond what is simply there on the surface. I think in the opportunities God brings us, there are times when we can sort of do the right thing, but there's still something more yet to be done. Sometimes we do what's not wrong, but there's something yet further. I'd like to quote from a writer, Larry Crabb, in a book, Soul Talk, in which he tries to get at this, particularly as we relate to other Christians. There's applications outside the church, but I'm thinking within the Christian fellowship. Sample. He writes in his book, Soul Talk, quote, "We may notice the unknown pew sitter. We may wonder how the teacher of a now small class feels, or we might worry over each member of a torn-up family, and we feel guilt for the pain of a woman who's ended her baby's life, but," says Crabb, "but we do what's easier. We design programs, we brainstorm ways to build attendance, and in our outrage over divorce statistics and abortion numbers, we fight for family values. These are good things," he says, "but we don't necessarily talk to the pew sitter. We don't ask the teacher how he's feeling. We don't invite the lonely dad over to play golf, or the woman to lunch, or the little boy to play with our children. We don't let the aborting woman know we care about her. He says, time is one problem, but feeling uncomfortable in how we speak to struggling people is a bigger one. As a result, he says, I love this phrase, he says, souls are never entered, and people remain unknown, undiscovered, and untouched. While programs sometimes flourish, ministries grow, moral campaigns get press, he says, across the world, people in record numbers are living the tragedy of an unobserved life. And for people desperate to be noticed, forgiven, and wanted, there is no greater tragedy. And I'd like to leave this with you because it seems to me that people like this Mary could push the envelope and go beyond just the right thing, and with a perception into, in this case, the timing of Jesus' ministry, and remembering what he had done for her and her family, valuing that. We can't equal that. That's a unique circumstance, I know. But one of the things we can do, and I'm tying this in with this morning's message, if we have the security of being people who were chosen, people who were elected, people who were brought close, God loved us before we were lovable. He already loved us. We already have the wealth. How much more energetically could we stretch into the lives of others around us, close to us in many cases, and be something incredibly dear, ourselves being precious gifts to them as much as them being treated as precious gifts in our lives. I hope to encourage you with this. Blessings on you as you check out the possibilities. Father in heaven, we'd like eyes to see. And among the many things to be seen, seeing as much as we're allowed into the souls of others would be a very good place to begin. Perhaps today, perhaps this week, perhaps in the way this week will unfold, you will bring us close to people who are not sure how to meet soul to soul, but with the eyes of perception, such as were modeled by Mary, and of course we see in an example of Christ over and over again, may we be the means by which the love of heaven is extended and given closely and personally and tenderly, and may we be the hands and the feet through which your grace, at least in some aspects of your grace, is extended to our needy world. I pray this in Jesus' name for myself and for others here. Amen.